Hello, and welcome to episode 2 of The Winning Agenda. Tonight, our panelists include local judge, tournament organiser, and contributor to the Australian Tabletop Gaming Network, Thomas Daniel.
Hey, guys.
Runner-up for both the 2014 Melbourne Regionals and the 2014 Australian Nationals, Liam Prasad.
Hey there.
Two-time store champion and two-time Magic the Gathering Pro Tour competitor, Wilfie Horrig.
Hey, what's up?
2014 Adelaide Regional champion and 2014 Australian National champion, Jesse Marshall.
Hello.
And I'm Brian Holland, 2014 Australian Nationals top 8 competitor. So this week, we're going to dive straight into it. We've got some spoilers from Up and Over, and we're going to be talking about them, where we think they might fit into certain decks, how they might affect the meta, and what cards that these cards could trump that are currently being played. The first card is Architect. It's a Sentry Ice. Cost 4, Strength 3. Architects cannot be trashed while installed. The first subroutine is the Corp looks at the top 5 cards of R&D and may install one of those cards, ignoring all costs. The second subroutine is the Corp may install a card from Archives or HQ, paying all costs. So,
and Tom, it's House Buy Road to Influence.
It is House Buy Road to Influence.
I think this is really good. I think that it kind of fits, maybe fortunately or unfortunately, in the same area as Ichi 1. In that it's a sentry with no end-the-run subroutine. Though, I guess Architect you really want early, whereas Ichi you kind of want in that mid-to-late game once the runner's starting to assemble their rig, just to kind of slow them down quite significantly because it's quite painful to get through. I think the static effect is quite interesting. What do you guys think about it not being able to be trashed?
It's more Parasite hate, and it's good.
Mm-hmm.
It's powerful.
Yeah, and especially if it is early on, if it's in your opener and you've set it up, they can't, you know, use that first Parasite to break it down. And especially if they are playing Anarch or a deck based around Parasite and trashing stuff, then they can't, you know, you're going to be getting a lot more ice out if they start hitting it a couple of times, or at least a lot more cards installed.
Yeah, it's going to be quite expensive to go through with any standard breaker, and the fact that it doesn't end the run, it means that when you put it on R&D or when you put it on HQ, it is going to see a lot of accesses, and you will be able to advance your board position quite quickly and trigger your identity off your opponent's turns.
Yeah, I was going to say one of the weaknesses of this card is that one of the best HB ice in existence is Rototurret, and people in general, I know when I play Ace HB and they've got face down ice on their centrals, I'm always wanting to have a mimic out before I run face down ice. So, if I've got other programs out, I mean, this may be just complete early game, you know, when they're running blind, you might be able to get them once or twice, and that might be enough benefit. But then, yeah, then you're going to have less stuff in archives, so you got to rely on it, having something relevant in HQ. I don't know. I mean, it's, in some senses, it falls within the sort of Neural Katana stat level, which is not a great place to be. It does have 2 subroutines, which is better than Neural Katana, but yeah, I'm not sure that you're going to be seeing these subroutines fire all that often.
I mean, if you were to say, like, a HP deck has both Roto and Architect in it, then it means if you are running early without programs, this is where you want that. And when they're running, but you still have the Roto turret to threaten them to have that mimic out if they're going to start running with other programs.
Yeah, I know against HB, I like to face check for as long as I can before I do need to genuinely start accessing or threatening an access at least. Having an Architect around as HB lets me profit off that.
Some people have also mentioned with this card, it can, not sure if I agree with this, but I'd love to hear what you guys think. It can benefit Accelerated Beta Test. Anyone got any thoughts on that?
In what sense?
In the sense that you knowing the top cards of your deck, you may know when you want to trigger beta test on it.
Oh, sure. Yep.
Yeah, that's definitely like a plus side. I mean, between that and having Jackson Howard and stuff, like you probably have some good, like you'll have opportunities to fire off some guaranteed beta tests. But
yeah, or opportunities to shuffle away choice agendas.
Yeah.
with a Jackson. Yeah. That information isn't useless.
The next card is Ashigaru. It's a barrier. Cost 9, strength 4, and has Ashigaru gains End the Run subroutine for each card on HQ. It's a Jinteki card with three influence. Basically, this is just a really big barrier. Should be sweet. I imagine it'll probably replace something like, I can never pronounce it,
Susanna no Mikata.
There you go, yeah. Anyone else have anything to share about Ashigaru?
I don't think it's going to see play outside of Jinteki at three influence.
No, I can't imagine that being the case either.
It just gives it gives Jinteki another option. It's got multiple subroutines.
Has End the Run on it, which is good for Jinteki.
Yeah, that's pretty much what you can say about it, I think.
Yeah.
It still eats a Morningstar.
Yeah, you will. Yeah. I mean, we're very scared of Morningstar.
Well, you kind of want to be if it's a massive piece of ice. I mean,
yeah.
You don't want to get absolutely hosed by
just
a random Morningstar.
But it's efficient enough that it will see play, I think. That is good enough for it to be viable.
Yeah, the area that it suffers maybe in that, like, that low strength means... The low strength and high res cost means it's very, like... I would want to parasite this, and I'd feel really good about doing so.
That's true, yeah.
It's the problem with a lot of the low-strength, high-cost Jinteki Ice, Tsurugi, etc. Kamainu.
The next cards we have are a pair of cards. They're both NBN, and both have one influence. The first is Reversed Accounts. It's an asset. It has a cost of 0 and a trash cost of 3. It reads, Reversed Accounts can be advanced, and it has Click, Trash. The runner loses 4 credits for each advancement token on reversed accounts. The next card is Universal Connectivity Fee. It's a trap ice with cost 2 and strength 2. The subroutine is the runner loses 1 credit unless the runner is tagged. If the runner is tagged, he or she loses all credits in his or her credit pool and the corp trashes Universal Connectivity Fee. So Jesse, you've been an NBN player in the past. What do you think of these two cards?
Yeah, I really like Making News at the moment. I know there's a lot of hype around Near Earth Hub, and they're really aggressive, tutoring for Astroscript, trying to score out 7 as quickly as possible game plan. I think these cards really lend themselves to the slower Making News, Scorched Earth game plan. Reversed Accounts allows you to, drain the runner's credits to set yourself up for a sea source, and if you put it behind some threatening ice, which you're presumably playing, if you're also trying to kill them, you might be playing Shinobis, or you might not actually be playing Scorched Earth, but anyway, place it around some threatening behind some threatening ice. You can force them to run it. If they don't run it, they still lose out because they're losing all their credits. I think that's quite a powerful effect, and having a trash cost of 3 is really huge for a trap, and a res cost of 0. So I think it's quite good. Universal Connectivity Fee, it combos really, really well with Data Raven. I think Data Raven's one of the best ice in that archetype, in the Making News Scorched Earth archetype. Keeps them out of your centrals for a long time. And later in the game, what this reads, if you put it outside of that Data Raven, is that even if they are willing to take the tag later in the game, because they think they've got the economic advantage over you, if they can't break this, which is a trap, it doesn't have one of the common ice subtypes, if they can't break this, then they're losing all the credits in their credit pool for taking that Data Raven tag, so that's massive.
It also means they can't run repeatedly. You can put Data Raven behind the connectivity fee, and they can't run there repeatedly. Once they take the tag, they'll have to get rid of it. And even if you can't tag them, I actually quite like this, just compared to... it's kind of a similar effect over the course of the game would be Pop-Up Window. Once they establish a Yog, it gains you a credit, but it costs them nothing. This will cost them a credit every single time, regardless whether you tag them or not.
Yeah, I mean, you're saying that these cards are going to be really, like, ideal for the Making News archetype. Do you see them seeing play outside of that?
Reversed Accounts, you could definitely splash at one influence into Wayland. If people are taking up my advice from the last podcast and not running a lot against Wayland, this really punishes them for doing that. If you allow them to build up a few advancement tokens on this over, say they install advance and then advance trash, that's 16 credits you're losing, which is backbreaking for any runner who's trying to stockpile credits against Wayland.
What about outside of Scorched Earth?
I don't see it being nearly as good. When there aren't so many situations where the runner's going to be stockpiling credits unless you're playing Scorched Earth or a control deck and they're sitting back in that control mode. And if the runner's somewhere, which runners generally are, between 5 and 10 credits, this is not a particularly strong card because you have to hit them at exactly the right time and they have to be on that amount of credits on your turn.
If you're trying to use reversed accounts to create a scoring window, well, reversed accounts requires a scoring window, so it's kind of moot.
Moving on, we have a new Wayland identity, Blue Sun. It's 45 minimum deck size, 15 influence. The text on it is, when your turn begins, you may add one res card to HQ and gain credits equal to its res cost. Liam, what do you think?
Haipu. This card's pretty cool. I really like it. I don't want to go balls deep, including maybe like Adonis campaigns and things like that, to try and bring back to hand after milking them a little bit. But I do really just like the idea of being able to play a large piece of ice or play a Rotho, have it be made redundant, bounce it back, get my credits, and use that advantage to try and leverage in the sea source.
Sure. Jesse, do you have an opinion?
Yeah, I think generally with the core set ID, you're probably going to be gaining maybe 4 to 5 credits in a good game off that. And it seems reasonably likely that when your ice gets switched off in the mid game, as a lot of ice generally does, being able to return them to your hand and gain the credits back is probably going to give you more of an advantage.
Can you see yourself playing this over the core set card in your current Wayland deck?
Yeah, I think the only disadvantage is that the boosts that you get from Beanstalk royalties and hedge fund early that allows you to get up to 10 to play restructure is quite important. So your hedge fund's gaining you 5 and your Beanstalk's gaining you 4 helps you to get up to 10 to play restructure, which is good. So you would lose that synergy a little bit. But I'd be really interested in testing this and finding out whether the ability not only to gain back the credits for your ice that's become redundant, but also to redeploy ice where you need to, it overcomes that, which I think it may.
I also really like the synergy here between Blue Sun and Lothar's Field. Just being able to play your standard Yoggable Code Gates and then a Lothar's Field, but then bounce those Code Gates back, let you have a good spread of Code Gates across all strengths without having to lean so heavily on the Lothar's Field. So
that's true.
It gives you kind of a synergy there where you get to have a lot of selection in what you're doing with them.
Do you feel like if you're not playing like restructures and that type of stuff, that you would try to include some kind of asset economy to, you know, dirtle around with whilst you're waiting to put ice back into HQ?
I don't think I would change the economy cards that I'm playing. I don't see this as something that interacts with assets. Personally, I don't think that's the powerful way to play this. I think it's very much about bouncing ice. There are people who are going to try and play with the root. There are people going to try and play with upgrades. I really don't think that that's going to be as reliable because in every game, you're going to be installing your ice. And yeah, when I said that the synergy between Beanstalk and Hedge Fund and Restructure is not as good with this, that doesn't mean I wouldn't play those cards. It's just you lose a little bit of the advantage early in the game and trade that in for some late game power.
Excellent. Also in Wayland, we have a Changeling. It's a barrier morph ice with strength 5 and cost 4. Sorry, I got that around the wrong way. It's cost 5, strength 4. It's in Wayland with 2 influence. It has the text, Changeling can be advanced. While Changeling has an odd number of advancement tokens on it, it gains sentry and loses barrier. And it has a subroutine and the run. Wilfie, what do you think about this card?
I think this card's really good. The fact that it offers a reasonable cost to strength ratio and requires your opponent to have 2 disparate icebreaker types to break it is really is a powerful ability. The fact that you have to pay not necessarily only in credits but in actions to change it around is a bit awkward, but I like that you can play it on a central early, and its strength is high enough that they have to spend a reasonable amount of resources to get through it, and when they do have the ability to do that, you can just switch it around, and then they need to find another icebreaker.
I think it's just massive. Being able to change the ice type of your ice is huge. Sentry breakers against Wayland, a lot of people are going to be using fairies to try and get through your archers, and they're going to try and take that easy route. So if you can have more sentries that are sort of middle strength and force them to either blow their fairies on those or install a whole sentry breaker just to deal with this, then that's massive.
Given that you can put the runner behind just by changing it up, is it, I think this card actually leans itself into, again, an asset-based game where you can have the remote, have something behind it, have it be reasonably well protected for a good portion of the game, and then when it stops being protected, switch it around. And before coming into the very, very late game, unless you do get to hit them with an archer, you will have a lot of time to kind of milk that asset. whatever's in there. So I think it actually synergizes really well with Blue Sun as well, and I like to see them both in the same package. I think there's a really good deck there. Maybe with Sansan, I would be willing to test it out.
Indeed. Last not least, the only runner card we're going to talk about from this pack is Trade-In. It's a one-cost event in Shaper with two influence. As an additional cost to play this event, trash an installed piece of hardware, gain credits equal to half the install cost of the trashed hardware, rounded down, and set your stack for a piece of hardware, reveal and add it to your grip, shuffle your stack. Obviously, this is the only, I believe, the only hardware tutor we've seen in the game so far. So, Jesse, what do you think of this card?
Yeah, I think it's massive. Synergizes so well with Clone Chip. You can install Clone Chip for free with Kate early on, leave it sitting there. When you find a trade-in, your Clone Chip not only retrieves programs from your heap, but it also allows you to search your stack for any hardware that you want. I just think it's going to make it the decks that want to play important hardware. I mean, Plascrete's important, but then the core hardware is R&D Interface and Desperado in my particular deck. Being able to fetch those more reliably off a Clone Chip is huge.
Excellent. Anyone else have anything they'd like to add on trade-in?
I was just going to say quickly that I think basically any tutor has the chance of being playable. Just if it costs a reasonable amount to play, then it can enable archetypes by itself by allowing you to more consistently get, as Jesse said, the core hardware that you need. And while we can slot it in conventional decks, we can also, I could definitely also see this inspiring new decks built around maybe hardware that we haven't seen in as great a quantity in the past.
Yeah. Jesse, just quickly, what flexibility do you think you'll gain in your Kate deck with those three extra influence from a Desperado? Would you consider taking one out and playing something new?
Probably not. Clone chips are already quite valuable, so I wouldn't want to be relying every game on trading one of my clone chips in for a Desperado, because having the ability to recur Parasite is so important. But having the option to do it is definitely a good thing.
Of course. What about playing additional hardware? Is there anything you would consider playing to go with the trade-ins?
Not really. Being able to fetch your Plascretes is also really important in the matchups where that's important. It might allow me to go down to one Plascrete. That could be something.
Excellent. So we'll certainly look forward to seeing these cards in action in the coming weeks. So moving on into our deck tech for the episode, we'd really like to hear from Wilfie on his Hasbiroid Fast Advance deck. Really interested to know, Wilfie. I think it's known very well in our group that you would not play a deck unless you thought it was the best. And commonly, a lot of people think that Near Earth Hub or NBN is the best fast advance deck. So what advantages and disadvantages do you think HB Fast Advance has over NBN?
Well, first of all, I'd just like to say that I think there's a bit of an overemphasis on factions when talking about a categorization of decks. Like, people usually... like, I would say that this deck is actually quite similar to the Near Earth Hub deck because it shares a lot of the cards and it shares the same general strategy. But people categorize, like... people are like, what deck are you playing? And some people say HB, and then that serves as a categorization mechanism, whereas I don't think that's as reasonable. I don't think that's as like efficient of a way to say things. So I would say that this deck's actually quite similar to NBN, but I think it has, I guess going back to your question, I think it has some key advantages, and the biggest advantage is the identity. That being able to gain a credit each time you install a card just makes your economy much better and allows you to play a bit more ice that costs a bit more and is a bit heavier, and I think that's important against a lot of decks at the moment, especially the most common decks, Andromeda and Kate. I think that having ice, which is more efficient and able to stop them in over the longer game, is a bit better because those decks are so focused on gaining advantages through running.
And you think that the advantage of that extra credit is better than the card advantage you'd get from something like Near Earth Hub?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that it you're more likely to trigger it every turn, and it's something that you definitely want to do each turn, is really important. The fact that it allows you to play, as I said, heavier ice and be sure to res them early is really important, whereas drawing cards is strong, especially as you move into the later stages of the game where you need to find the pieces to win, but not as effective early, whereas I think HB, the HB identity shines earlier in the game.
Excellent. Does anyone have any questions for Wilfie on his HB, Jesse?
Yeah. I was wondering, Wilfie, why do you? What do you think the advantages of the mid cost ice are? Like you've got, you're playing three Victor twos, which are five to res, is that right? Yeah,
that's correct.
Roto turrets are four to res. There's quite a bit of ice there that costs quite a bit. How does that impact on the way you play? And do you think it's as fast as Neurothub?
It's definitely not as fast as Neurothub. That's while they're similar. Neuro, I think the main disadvantage is that you don't get the ability to win as quickly through chaining Astro scripts. But I think it's a reasonable trade-off to make for being able to claw back advantage in the mid-game and late-game. Like, I found that Neurothub playing with, seeing and playing against Neurothub, I find that the deck seems to, when your opponent can set up a rig, you can't really do anything to keep them out of your servers. You just have to hope that the game doesn't get to the point where they've set up their rig and they can start running each action. But I think that the HB deck is a bit slower and a bit more able to handle that situation where they can, they've completed their rig and they're able to run. I think you can still easily win from that position.
Yeah, because your ice is more taxing. The other question I had is that accelerated beta test, I know in our testing you were triggering it a lot more frequently than you were perhaps a year ago. Why is that, and how do you think accelerated beta test has changed, particularly the way you use it?
A couple of reasons. The first is obvious, of course, the main safeguard to beta test hitting agendas is Jackson, and usually it's often good against lots of runner decks based around Data Sucker and that kind of effect to place ice on archives anyway. So even if you, because they don't know, of course, that you've hit an agenda, so if you put, say, two ice, one, and you already have an ice on archives, often they won't run and it gives you time to find a Jackson. So even if you hit an agenda, it's still not always the worst. And also, with the introduction of, as I changed my deck, I found that the ice costs got a bit, rose a little bit, and so that makes accelerated beta test a bit better, because it's more likely to find something impactful, and also because the deck's split of ice types is really good, I find that a big advantage, that you can often, say, put two different ice types on the server with accelerated beta test, which makes it really hard for the runner to get in and is a huge speed bump.
Cool. Just quickly, I also wanted to ask about the 3-for-1s. You're playing Director Haas's pet project and Gillahan's Arcology. Considering that NBN has access to two breaking news, and then we have messed around with other fast advanced styles in the past, is the fact that you don't have any access to a 2-for-1 a bit of a deal breaker? Clearly it's not, but...
It is important to consider. Like, it would be good to have a 2-for-1. Obviously we can consider the comparison to domestic sleepers, which is kinda a 2-for-1, but not in the sense that you get to replace a point from your deck from it. So I think that domestic sleepers, while replicating a 2-for-1 a little bit, doesn't really have the efficiency. But I think that the 3-for-1s have strong enough effects, especially Haas's pet project, that has a very impactful effect a lot of time when you score it, that it's not a huge deal, although it is definitely a drawback.
So the Director Haas's pet project often lets you come into the mid-game or the late-game with a bit more of a robust board presence?
Yeah, it's insanely good. The fact that you get to... Often you have an Adonis in the bin, or you can... you've had a Jackson that they've trashed, or a Sansan that they've trashed, often from that you have installed, and the fact that you get to recur those, or an Ash, in fact, and the fact that you get to recur those is really powerful.
Just lastly, Wilfie, what's some advice you would give to some people if they sit down opposite you or anybody else playing HB Fast Advance in a tournament? How would you suggest playing against the deck?
I would say that the main thing is the threat of Sansan, and how that affects the way people should play. Because the deck isn't as fast as NBN, you're not as pressured to hit their hand in their R&D early, their HQ in their R&D early, but you have to be considerate over the course of the game that it's very easy to create a server that's impenetrable or difficult to penetrate and then put a Sansan into it and start scoring. So I'd say that maybe playing a bit slower and trying to establish a board presence, and especially playing around Rotor Turret, would be more important than it would be against NBN Fast Advance. But otherwise, the matchups are quite similar.
And in terms of Sansan, just quickly, Wilfie, on that point, do you find that people are often trashing Sansans from central servers, and do you think that's a mistake?
Yeah, I find that a lot of people have some misconception about Sansan, that it's the reason that the deck wins, and while it is the most important card, so it's easy to see how that might occur, there are actually lots of ways to deal with Sansan apart from trashing it. You can run our HQ and flush the hand out of agendas, say with legwork or with HQ interface, or just by running a lot, or with, say, Parasite to Parasiting Ice, or just having a lot of money, or running R&D and establishing an R&D lock, say, with R&D interface or the Maker's Eye. So I'd say that those two are reasonable ways to deal with the Sansan apart from trashing it, and it's really important to understand what stage of the game or what the correct way to go about dealing with Sansan is.
Is there a kind of a board presence that you would consider critical to? Is there a turning point in the game where you just kind of win? Maybe when you have a Sansan behind an Ash or two?
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of situations where you have ice on HQ, ice on a remote, and ice on R&D. Like, you don't even need that many ice, but once you have a Sansan going, you put them immediately under pressure, and they have to respond. If they don't respond, they lose.
Excellent. Okay, just moving into our last topic for the episode. Just talking a little bit about the Anarch faction. I know that Tom and Jesse have been doing a bit of testing, both with Noise and Quetzal. Tom, can you tell us what you've found with Quetzal lately?
Sure. So I guess when I first looked at Quetzal, the initial thought, and I think a lot of people kind of jumped to this, is the early game aggression. So I'd played a Noise account Siphon Recursion deck at a at Adelaide Regionals, which Jesse was there at, and I felt like it fared quite well. And when I saw Quetzal, I was like immediately like, this is a perfect shell. Like, this identity is much better than Noise for that, because they can't just put a wraparound on HQ to keep your account siphons out and stuff like that. So I whipped it up. It's pretty straightforward. Three account siphons and three express deliveries for the influence. And I think it does a good job, but it has the same old Anarch problem where if you don't get on top of them really early and capitalize on a lot of your early game cards, or your aggressive cards rather, like account siphon and mediums and nerve agents and stuff like that, imp, then you really just fall behind, and you are never winning a long game, it feels, with Anarch. I don't know, Jesse, do you feel the same?
Yeah, I guess I've actually designed this the Noise deck that I've been testing a bit around Hades Shard, which I think is a really, really powerful card. For those of you who are unaware of the specific interaction, you can install Hades Shard from your hand for 7, and they don't have a window to respond with any actions before you can crack it. So you can install the Hades Shard and trash it to access archives before they have a window to use Jackson Howard. So I know a lot of people, when I play against them, don't activate their Jackson Howard, don't remove it from the game until you've run Jackson or archives just to waste the click. Hades Shard allows you to punish people for doing that. So yeah, I guess the Noise deck is therefore a little less aggressive. It's still running the account siphon same old thing as a an economy base, because I think that's the best economy base in Anarch, unfortunately, because it costs 12 influence. But yeah, the fact that you have another plan where you can, if you can trash 4 or 5 cards off R&D and then access them with Hades Shard late in the game, it can get you that last 2 points that you need quite reliably.
Also, Liam, you were the runner-up at 2014 Melbourne Regionals with a Noise deck. I know you've since come off playing Noise, but I still think you are a resident Anarch. What are some of the problems you might have faced, or the advantages that you think you had when playing Noise?
Well, yeah, wow. Noise, from my perspective in Anarch, and from my perspective in general, just always felt spread way too thin. You want to draw cards, you want to establish a rig like any runner, you want to generate an economy, you want to have access to an economy that's more efficient, which every runner wants. But with Anarch, it always felt like you either got to choose one or the other. You either got to run effectively and be aggressive, or you got to have a rig and do nothing with it, or you got to have a strong economy powered by things like liberated accounts and And just nothing ever happened. You ended up with 1 million credits and you needed to run on Crypsis, so you lost that 1 million credits because you couldn't put a rig together because you can't draw cards. So what I ended up doing was running John Masanori for a long time and really opened myself up to just that tag and bag strategy. You end up with all the tags because, frankly, you can't go through everything all the time.
Yeah.
So John Masanori was fine though. You want to run, you want to be powered by maybe a Desperado if you have the influence, or you want to be powered by a Datasucker. Datasucker is insane, and Parasite is insane. And so having access to Datasucker, Parasite, Clone Chip was especially good in the noise builds I tried. Really just forcing the Corp to spread their ice thin by requiring them to ice up archives and then punishing them with Parasite and with Clone Chip. People have kind of wisened onto the Parasite since then, though. So even now, where we can move on to a Hades Shard or
Cache build.
a Kaish build, maybe. Kaish, it's influenced. The deck doesn't necessarily have three Kaishes. It's self-modifying code. This is Desperado. Like, it's a lot to choose from. And all these cards that we want to put into Anarch keep feeling like they're coming from different factions. And all these great in-faction cards from Anarch keep feeling like they want to be different.
Yeah.
Quetzal feels like she wants to be a criminal.
And just lastly, do we feel where Anarch is at the moment that there's possibly a tier one deck on par with something like Kate or Andromeda at the moment?
I think we're coming to a really sweet point. I think Quetzal is going to be a bit of a turning point. I can really see this fantastic mid-game orientated deck from Quetzal that consistently threatens to run remotes, and from there really abuses that threat to power through with maybe an HQ interface or legworks and a medium. Anything on par with, not necessarily Desperado, but anything even on par with security testing or with professional context would be a massive boon.
Anarch has a lot of destructive cards, which makes sense, but the problem with, even Noise's ability is the high variance. It can be so powerful sometimes, but other times it does nothing. And as you said, Shirley, sometimes you're able to assemble a rig, sometimes you just have a great opening hand and the top five cards are fantastic. But if that doesn't come together, your deck doesn't have the inbuilt redundancy to overcome that, and you don't have the powerful dig or the powerful economy to be able to deal with those games where it doesn't all go to plan.
At regionals with Noise, I went less than 50-50, and more than a few of those games, I just didn't find a Kuroda,
No special order.
no special order. And coming out at the end of the day, I said, well, if I'm going to play Noise, I should just play a Crypsis. And we have Overmind now, which is another AI breaker, and I think it's worth considering testing something like Overmind.
I think Knight is the big one of the parts, one of the things that fixed a lot of problems with Anarch, in that you have a, something that's more efficient than Crypsis, more efficient than Overmind, but it still just kills your economy late in the game because it's just so expensive.
If it is a massive threat, they can still trash it. And like with not Hades Shard, but Hades
Fragment.
Fragment, the two words mean the same thing.
Yeah.
It's really frustrating.
Yeah.
Even with Hades Fragment,
No,
if they want,
Hades Shard is the noise card, is the runner
Hades
card.
Shard is the noise card. Excellent. So even with Hades Shard, if they want to play around it, they just can. It's not like in Wayland where the Scorched demands a Plascrete. We're talking about a situation where if somebody wants to beat Noise or wants to beat a standard Anarch playing something like Hades Shard or playing something like a heavy Parasite build, they can make some very small decisions that don't affect their game drastically to gain a massive edge over you, and it's because of that high variance.
Excellent. Well, hopefully going forward in the coming weeks and months, we'll maybe see some tier one Anarch on the field if things start to shape up for them.
Yeah, things are gonna have to change just
Just a
enough.
little bit. Hopefully that comes with Order and Chaos, or maybe with some more delving into Quetzal testing, as Thomas suggested. That's about all we have time for this episode. As usual, we remind you guys that we'd love to hear from you. You can send us an email at thewinningagenda@gmail.com. This week we're also running a bit of a competition. The question that we deem to be our favorite question, that person will receive a copy of Up and Over as soon as it's available in Australia. We'll ship it out to you. So please, when you do email us your question, include your forwarding address, postal address.
Is that available to people outside of Australia?
Certainly, certainly, we'll definitely do that. That's all we have time for, so we look forward to speaking to you next week. Bye, guys.
See ya.